This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Hi, it's Leia, and I'm on Diesel's sustainability journey. I'm going for an all-out immersion into the world of Diesel denim, and you get to come with me. Come on. We're going to a laundry, a farm, a factory. I'm going to talk to customers. I'm going to do everything to really get under the skin of the brand. Discover more on Diesel.com.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly, a podcast that is unafraid to challenge the one-dimensional and reductive thinking around immigrant identity. I am Sadia Khan. Have you ever been told that your stories don't matter or that your narratives have no audience? Well, I've heard it countless times myself, yet I persevere with unwavering grit and commitment to create a safe and honest space for both your stories and mine. My guest today is doing the same. Danielle Alvarengo is a journalist whose work has highlighted the many crimes and human rights crises in Central America, including El Salvador, where his family is originally from. He's made video work with Al Jazeera Plus channel on YouTube covering topics like the history of Palestinians living in El Salvador and raising awareness about Dominican-owned bodegas in New York City. His new podcast, UMO, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, uncovers stories of crime and journalism. Daniel and I talked about so many things on this episode, from his childhood in LA to the history of El Salvador and US involvement in the country's politics. So, without further ado, let's get started. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well.
You're based in DC, right?
Yes, I'm based in Washington, DC, but I'm originally from California.
Okay, so how do you like DC?
I love it. So my family's from El Salvador, Central American country, and the largest immigrant group in DC are people from El Salvador. And I didn't know that. I always knew that I had like cousins here and I had distant family here, but I didn't realize that DC's largest immigrant group was from El Salvador. So I love it here. It feels like an extension of home. I like other parts of DC that don't have to do with Salvadorans, but to me, that's what makes it really special.
That's good to know. I feel like having that sense of community always helps. Where I live in New York, at least in the suburbs, I do have that community, but not in the town that I live. And that does make things harder. But I'm glad you found your community in DC. And you're a journalist, Danielle. I've been listening to your podcast, UMO. It's a brilliant production. And I have questions about production as well. As a podcaster, I always have questions about that.
Okay.
And the content is incredible. But before we delve into that, I just want to go back to your story. Your family fled from El Salvador. You were born in the US, but your siblings were born in El Salvador. Your mom left when civil war erupted. Did your family tell you about their journey to the US and the things they went through as you were growing up?
Absolutely. I think that's what set me off on this path. With parents who fled the war in El Salvador, the war from 1980 to 1992, I feel like you have two sets of parents. People who want to forget because of the atrocities. And then you have people who don't want to forget. So my parents, I feel like they thought, especially because I was the American-born child, that I was going to assimilate and forget where I came from. So they tried really hard to just remind me of why they were here and, you know, got to me before maybe any school textbook could and set the story straight, especially because the war in El Salvador in the United States was a very polarizing topic. There was an anti-war movement, and there was a sanctuary movement alongside it, and there was a lot of support from the right wing, particularly Reagan and Bush, to keep funding the war.
Central America is America. It's at our doorstep, and it's become the stage for a bold attempt by the Soviet Union, Cuba, and Nicaragua to install communism by force throughout the hemisphere.
So, yeah, my parents, if anything, they overshared, so that I don't forget.
And how did that impact your childhood, your outlook on life?
There's one thing hearing the stories, and there's another thing being able to visit. And for me, it always made me feel like I was different in the sense, in Los Angeles, Latinos are a big group, and Salvadorans within that group aren't as big. So many people who are Latino in California and Los Angeles are from a Mexican background. I grew up around a lot of Latinos and Spanish language, and that was great. It made me retain my Spanish language. But there was not a lot of Salvadorans at the time. We were a new immigrant group in the 80s and 90s because of the war. And so I always thought like, oh, you know, what's the difference between us and Mexicans? And then my parents would be like, well, you know, we have a different culture. We come from a different country. And I was like, oh, okay. But it wasn't until I went to El Salvador as a four-year-old, maybe in 1993, a year after the war ended, was when I really realized, oh, El Salvador is a very different place from what I know. And some of my earliest memories were being able to go to El Salvador. And it was a privilege because, like I said, my siblings fled from El Salvador. They didn't have the migration status, the immigration status to be able to travel at a young age like I did. So, and knowing that privilege and recognizing that privilege, all of that shaped my experience and sort of showed me the contrast. Like, the United States is very different from El Salvador. And my young little brain was just trying to process it all.
Let's talk about differences between Salvadorian culture and Mexican culture, because I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners may not even be aware of what those differences are.
Yeah, so El Salvador and Mexico, they're not too far apart. There's one country between them, Guatemala, and, you know, the whole area, Mesoamerica, it was colonized by the Spanish a few hundred years ago. And so there is shared culture in terms of language, as well as the indigenous people from before in Mexico and El Salvador. There was lots of trade. There was lots of cultural exchange, and the borders were not what they are now. So there's a lot of cultural similarities between Mexico and El Salvador. And sometimes I don't blame people for getting this confused, but then you do get some frustrating essentialization. A lot of people will be like, oh, those people over there, they're Mexicans. And I'm like, no, they're from El Salvador. I can hear their accent. And, you know, I try to educate people as best as I can. But, you know, sometimes you do get some egregious things, like especially during the Trump administration, there was a lot of demonization of people coming from Central America and a lot of stereotypes that I think were pushed on us. And sometimes the conflation of Salvadorans and Mexicans can come from a place of ignorance and racism. And sometimes it just comes from a place of, well, that's a part of the world that not a lot of people learn about. So, you know, I try to be educational and try to let people know.
So what are some of the most ludicrous, stereotypical depictions that you've noticed, that you've seen people talk about?
Yes, I think the one that got really popular was that all people from Central America, especially El Salvador, are part of MS-13, or they know someone in MS-13, which is the gang that was created in the United States. And then it was a bunch of refugee children from El Salvador who came to the United States. They got criminalized and got set back, and they grew the gang. So I've had people tell me, like, oh, check his back for tattoos when I say I'm Salvadoran. And I'm like, come on. And yeah, so there has been that sense. And I think the Trump administration really, really, really tried to make MS-13 to be like scapegoats for Central American immigrants. And the gang problem in El Salvador is very complicated, and it's very much involved with the United States politics. But I feel like that's the biggest misconception you get. And from that, you just get that because we have a history of war and a history of gangs, a lot of people just assume violence, that we're violent people.
Daniel, I do want to expand this conversation a bit. And I'm sure the intersectionality of it, the confluence is very complicated. We can't cover it in one episode, but still, can you talk a little bit about gang violence and its association with U.S. foreign policy?
Yes. So the United States funded a war in El Salvador. They funded the right wing against a group of communist rebels. And so, you know, it was Reagan's policy to really go hard on these communist rebels. The war started with Jimmy Carter, but Reagan really escalated things in 1980 or whenever he came into power, 81. And conservative estimates say that around 200,000 Salvadorans died in this war. And we're a very small country of 6 million. And, you know, what happens in war is that, you know, you have a lot of orphans, you had a lot of children who have been affected by war. And so a lot of these children migrated to the United States through various means. And coming to the United States, they didn't have the support that a child escaping war should. We're talking the Reagan era, 1980s, especially, where a lot of social programs were cut. There wasn't a whole lot of looking after these children. So, and specifically in Los Angeles, these children started forming gangs to protect themselves. Los Angeles already had a very established gang culture, very established police culture as well. And so when these kids formed these gangs and got into all kinds of trouble to defend themselves or to survive, they were met with a very cruel criminal justice system. They got caught up in legal troubles. And so what ended up happening is that because they were not U.S. citizens, a lot of them got deported back. This happened especially in the 90s when Clinton passed a law called IRIRA, and I call it the immigrant sister to the crime bill. And it basically widened the criteria for deportation. So in the 90s, you see El Salvador receive a giant influx of gang members and deportees among them. And El Salvador specifically, it was still rebuilding from the war. It was from a decade of war. So it was not the society that had an infrastructure to really take these people in as well.
To accommodate them.
Yes. And so then they proliferated and they grew and they grew and they grew and they grew. They grew in the United States and they grew in Central America. And so then, you know, we had this problem, you know, in the Trump era, like, you know, these people are inherently violent, but there was never any sense of like, well, U.S. policies from war to immigration led to this chaotic thing.
It's interesting how U.S. foreign policy has impacted so many people from El Salvador to Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And people who've lived those experiences understand the harm these policies can cause and have been causing, right? But somehow that information doesn't get transmitted to people living in the United States. So how do you think people should educate themselves?
I think reading is fundamental. Audio, podcasts like these. Now we have social media. You know, I always tell people to find reputable sources for anything. And that's very hard in the time of misinformation. But I definitely think it happens at all levels. Books and media are one thing, but there's also the aspect of just your community and having access to oral histories of elders and people who were alive back then.
Yeah.
Apart from reading books, that's been the most powerful thing for me. It's because I know this happened because a loved one lived through it and told me about it. And not everyone has that. Not everyone has their community near them because of displacement and immigration. But seeking that out and seeking that out even through the internet sometimes can be helpful.
Now, I've listened to a few of your interviews, and you've talked about how a lot of stories coming out of Central America are not deemed necessary or important in newsrooms, right? Unless they are centered on gang violence or the so-called migrant crisis at the border. Can you parse out fact from fiction for listeners to determine whether that's true or not? Whether it's true that people living in the U.S. are not interested in stories, in human stories coming out of Central America? That's one. And two, can you talk about the vernacular that should be used in the U.S. social discourse for us to talk about these stories? Because you are critical of terms like the migrant crisis.
Yeah, I think I've always been told in newsrooms, especially during the Obama era when I graduated and started, you know, having a professional life for the first time, was that there was no audience for stories of people in Central America. And I was just like, what does that mean? That's very vague. It could mean people don't care. It could be, but I always thought as a media maker, as a journalist, it's our job to make people care. So oftentimes in newsrooms, I found myself sort of doing advocacy for stories in Central America. So for example, a lot of people don't know that people from El Salvador are the third largest Latino group now.
Hmm.
It goes, I think, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and then Salvadorans, which was a spot that was once held by Cubans. So I always tell people that, you know more Salvadorans or have interacted with more Salvadorans than you may have an idea. You might think they're Mexican or another Latino. And that's part of it. I know that's a big thing in D.C. where like a lot of people don't know. You know, a lot of people come from D.C. from all over the country and all over the world. And they may just assume that Latinos locally are Mexican and whatnot. You know, we talked about that a little bit, but that's just part of it. You know, coming up with these stats and statistics to justify. But at the end of the day, what happens in Central America affects the United States because that's where a lot of immigrants are coming from.
Right.
Yeah. So our communities are constantly welcoming people from these countries, whether the government likes it or not. So I think it's important just based on that. There's community people. If you live in the U.S., you probably have a community member or someone that you interact with that comes from Central America. But even if we didn't show up here, American tax dollars have funded this. So I always like to ask people who've been in this country for a while, and ask them, like, hey, you know, who did your parents vote for during the Reagan era? Or who did your grandparents vote for? Because that's a big reason why I'm here. And so part of it is that. And in terms of the vernacular, as long as people aren't calling us slurs or anything, it's very contentious sometimes, I think. You know, we say immigrant, we say asylum seekers, and those are right. Those aren't wrong. But people from El Salvador never really got a chance to officially call themselves refugees. If you look at the numbers from the 80s, somewhere around like 80 to 90 refugee applications from El Salvador were denied. The vast majority of people fleeing the war in El Salvador, especially in the 80s, did not get refugee status. And part of that is because I think if the United States was to grant refugee status and make people think of Central Americans as refugees, they would have to admit some wrongdoing.
Ah, very interesting.
There have been some concessions made in terms of immigration and sense of, like, there was a small amnesty law that helped certain people in the 80s. Not a small amnesty law, but it helped. It didn't help everybody. And then we've had TPS, temporary protected status, for a while. And so there have been some small, like, wins with immigration, but we've never been able to call ourselves refugees. And I sort of reiterated as a political point that my parents are refugees. Whether they got the status from the United States government or not, they fled war in a country. And that, to me, makes them refugees. And that's sort of contested, I think, still with us.
Apart from America admitting wrongdoing, what else would have happened if Salvadorans were granted refugee status?
Yeah, I think if Salvadorans were granted refugee status, there might have been a little bit of room to get services, to get help. I think what ended up happening with most people is that they just sort of fit this undocumented category that's very widespread. And you know, people just work underground, almost invisible-like. So refugee status would have brought some recognition, I think, to people. That being said, because there was a sort of abandonment, I will say, of refugees from El Salvador by the United States, we had a very strong sanctuary movement in the United States. A very strong movement to house immigrants, to make sure they don't get deported. And sometimes that gets written out of history a little bit, that the 1980s had a big sanctuary movement centered around people fleeing the wars in Central America. But as you know, sanctuary movements haven't gone away. We, especially around during the Trump era, there was a big surge in becoming a refugee or a sanctuary city. So I think that's also part of the legacy of Central Americans in the United States, that sanctuary movement in the 80s.
Daniel, when exploring the issues around Central American migration, what questions did you have specifically that you still need to see answered in the news? And have you been able to answer some of them?
Yes. Why? Why are they coming? Why have they been coming here? Why the United States? Why aren't we going to Costa Rica? Why aren't we just settling in Mexico? And I think American society has a problem with the why. I think for a long time, this country doesn't want to talk about its actions in foreign countries. One of the ones that is brought up a lot is Guatemala, 1950s, there was a coup, in part sponsored by a U.S. company, United Fruit Company, which ended up becoming Chiquita Banana. That set off a whole series of events that led to the war in El Salvador. So the why is the United States meddling in Central America? Why was there a coup in the 50s that led to war 3 decades later?
Did you find the answer to that why?
Well, I think, you know, we can go back to the Monroe Doctrine, where the United States thinks we're its backyards. I think that's a very big why. So the Monroe Doctrine, and just generally the U.S. foreign policy, has never really, really cared about us. I think part of the reason is that countries like ours in Central America are seen as that disparaging term, banana republics, which comes from the coup from United Fruit Company, Chiquita Bananas. Not to bring it back to the Trump era, but like really any time a government is acting like they think a third world country is supposed to be like, oh, our democracy is a farce because XYZ reason, they start being compared to banana republics. And banana republics to me connotes Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, any of the Latin American countries, really. But so I'm just kind of like, wait a minute. How are you using something like banana republic to be disparaging about something happening in the U.S. when the U.S. created those? We didn't happen in a vacuum, and Central Americans didn't happen in a vacuum. My parents are very clear that we came here because we had to. My mother, she was very clear. So it's like she spent the first 2 years in this country almost regretting her decision because, you know, you leave everything back home. It's not like, oh, the streets are paved with gold, I'm in this new country. Those first early years were very hard on my family. And it wasn't an ideal choice to come here. And I think one of those misconceptions is that, like, we're dying to come here. And it's just like, we're not dying to come here because America has, you know, freedoms and Starbucks and all these, you know, shiny things. But it's because home is unlivable. And why is home unlivable? Lots of factors.
That makes so much sense. But to play devil's advocate for a minute, people may say that countries don't care for other countries or other people. They care for their strategic interests. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, the United States really does just care about its interests in the region, in the sense that's why we had the war. Part of the reason El Salvador happened in terms of the war was because Cuba had a revolution.
So it was to quell communism.
Yes, right? Nicaragua had a revolution. So that's part of it. But, you know, the war didn't conclude on any, there wasn't any clear winner in the sense that, like, the guerrillas never had a full revolution. But also the government was kind of on its knees in a way. And so we had a peace treaty. And it just felt like in the peace treaties that we had in 1992, at the end of the day, U.S. corporate interest won. A lot of people say that the end of the war was partially brought on because it was no longer the Reagan era. There was another approach. The Berlin Wall fell, but also El Salvador needed to be opened back up for business. This whole decade had made a lot of foreign businesses leave El Salvador. And so when the peace accords came, you started seeing a whole lot of push towards neoliberal policies. So El Salvador privatized the phone company, privatize a lot of services. Even to this day, we're fighting privatization of water. So El Salvador started following the neoliberal economic model after the war. And since then, we've seen, you know, an increase of corporations in El Salvador from the U.S., but as well as we've seen a lot of migration as well. Because so many Salvadorans live in this country, many more people want to reunify with their family. And so now we have this sense where, like, the economy is very dependent on remittances from the U.S. So El Salvador is very tiny. Like I said, 6 million people in the grand scheme of things, it's not that big. It's the size of Massachusetts. Of those 6 million people, there are 2 million people living outside of it in the United States. So a third of El Salvador's population lives in the United States. And that creates this interesting dynamic where a lot of the country is economically dependent on the United States in a lot of different ways, from remittances to just the fact that the United States is the big economy in the region.
How do you think Salvadoran diaspora views the past and the present?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. You have people like me whose parents just overshared about El Salvador. And then you have people who don't know enough because their parents, either maybe they migrated because they were too young, or maybe they want to forget about the trauma of the war. And, you know, so you have a lot of Salvadoran Americans who are a bit out of touch with their culture, but at the same time, maybe they romanticize certain aspects of it. For instance, like people want to talk about the cultural products. So oftentimes diaspora will like cling on to these symbols. For example, one of them is the pupusa. The pupusa is the national dish of El Salvador. And it's a corn tortilla, basically, that's stuffed with cheese or bean and cheese, or meat and bean and cheese. And there's all these combinations. And that's like our national dish. I think a lot of Salvador diaspora, they just want to hold on to the positive. They just want to uplift the food and the music. El Salvador's music is very much like traditional stuff is very much a cumbia style of music, which is an Afro-Colombian rhythm that made its way to us. And so people want to celebrate these things because they're tired of hearing the same narrative that we're violent, that we're gang members, etc. And so I don't blame diaspora folks to want to like run away from the bad and just embrace the good. But I think what happens with that sometimes is that we lose sight of the bigger picture of why we came here and what is going on in El Salvador right now. El Salvador is living through a very interesting moment under a president, Nayib Bukele, who is very right-wing, very authoritarian, but he's getting rid of the gangs. And so that's seen as a positive. It doesn't matter if he's throwing people in jail without trial. It doesn't matter that he's funding the military, not funding the schools. A lot of people just are like, oh, I want a safe El Salvador so that I can visit. So a lot of these diaspora people, they go to El Salvador for 2 weeks, and then that's sort of the extent of it all.
Yeah.
And then they come back. But I have some friends and family members who want to go to El Salvador. They're Salvadoran American like me. They were born in this country. They want to travel. They can travel. And their parents are like, no, it's too dangerous. Their parents may not have been there in 20 years, but, you know, the trauma and everything is lingers. And so now with this new president, Nayib Bukele, he puts the best picture forward for El Salvador, where El Salvador is adopting cryptocurrency. It's meeting the 21st century. All the bad guys are in jail. It's safe to visit now. He's courting a lot of influencers, Bitcoin influencers, cryptocurrency influencers. And so to the average Salvadoran, it looks like, wow, people are visiting El Salvador. It's becoming a tourist destination.
But are you talking about an average local Salvadorian or somebody from diaspora?
Diaspora. We look at the country at this period right now through rose-colored glasses because it seems to us better than our war-torn past.
But what does an average Salvadorian living in El Salvador think?
Ooh, that really depends on a couple factors like economic class. But I will say that the average Salvadoran is really struggling to survive. We're all living this inflation. We're all, especially in the United States, we're living sort of all these price hikes. And El Salvador is a dollar economy, like I mentioned earlier. So they're feeling the same things too. And they make even less money. So, you know, some of the poorest people will make like $3 to $5 a day. And so people in El Salvador are still struggling to get by. Yes, there's more tourism now. But the tourism sector just benefits a select few, typically people who own land and resorts and things of that nature. The average Salvadoran is still struggling and they need healthcare. They need economic empowerment. All of these things aren't happening like they should. Right now, El Salvador is investing highly in militarization, investing in building jails. And so that looks like economic activity, you know, at first, but you know, it's creating jobs. People have to build those jails.
But then they have to fill those jails as well.
Yes, that's where we're at right now. So the average Salvadoran, it's hard to gauge sometimes because like a lot of people don't want to speak out against the government so openly. You kind of have to read between the lines. So maybe a Salvadoran won't tell you outright, I hate the president. But there's also a lot of people who feel that they have to go with the president because they feel that like he's like this absolute power. Do you have a lot of people who really do love the new president? But I'm getting the sense from people there that things aren't as rosy and happy as Nayib Bukele paints it out to be. And not everyone can speak out in the same way. And we get into that in the podcast, how journalists have been persecuted for telling the truth about what's going on. And, you know, especially if you're a working class Salvadoran from the more lower economic sectors, you're more likely to be picked up and thrown in the prison because you don't have any recourse. You probably don't have a high up working in the government that could take you out. And so what we're seeing is that a lot of the most vulnerable people are the people just being targeted indiscriminately, whether they committed a crime or not, being thrown in the jails. And that information does not get out enough on El Salvador.
Daniel, this is a great segue into the podcast itself. How would you describe its focus?
Okay, so the podcast is called Humo, Murder, and Silence in El Salvador.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador.
Que le den asilo y que se vayan, hombre. Si es que aquí no aportan nada. Si se quieren ir, que se vayan.
Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador.
Humo.
The story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor ministro, ¿dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero?
Humo is the Spanish word for smoke. So this podcast starts with a core story, which is a mass grave was found in the house of an ex-police officer. And, you know, a lot of these murder podcasts tend to focus on the guy who did the murder. He was a psycho. He was unwell. Where we turn that murder podcast mystery on its head and we're like, okay, it's not just one guy. It's a whole system that is failing people. And so, you know, we lure you in a little with that murder mystery podcast formula, and then we flip the switch and we're like, this is about power, this is about politics, and a lot of other stuff.
Every minute that passes is a lost opportunity to save this young woman's life. But the emergency operators don't seem to understand the urgency.
Sí, porque ya más antes que ustedes ya habían reportado, ¿cómo se llama? Pero cuando usted me llamó como a las, quiero ver.
11:49.
The clock keeps ticking. It's been more than 58 minutes since the first neighbor called 911.
Y después de eso ya no se escuchó nada.
Everything goes quiet. Once again, silence reigns in Estevez Alley, Chalchuapa, El Salvador. But not for long.
The original podcast was done in Spanish, and if you go on any of the streaming sites and you look for the podcast, the first 8 episodes look like they're in Spanish and the next 8 are in English. It's the podcast just done twice. So originally it was in Spanish and the host was Brian Avelar. Brian Avelar did the actual reporting. So I had been following the story. I had been following Brian's work since all of this started. So I was just an observer and, you know, I use my platforms to speak out. Brian, the original Spanish language podcast host and reporter, there was a time when we had to do a hashtag to get the government to leave him alone. And so I came in because they wanted to adapt it for the English-speaking audience, and not just the English-speaking audience, but they were very, very ahead of the curve in diagnosing the fact that there's a lot of Salvadoran Americans in the United States. And I think a lot of people don't think that we're an audience. Like I said, like, where's the audience for that? Sonoro Media knew there was an audience for that. And I really appreciate them because they could have gotten any American to do it. Anyone with a nice radio voice. They could have gone a lot of different directions. And I'm very grateful they came to me because my audience is primarily diasporic Salvadorans. So they understood the value that I had speaking directly to my people. And when I mean my people, I also mean not just people in El Salvador. I mean people who've had the experience of growing up Salvadoran in the United States. So the fact that they saw the value and that I can connect with them on that level, but that I also had parallel stories. Because all of us who come from El Salvador, whether we know it or not, whether our parents told us or not, there's a story that links us to the struggle and the oppression that has happened. And I was able to add in the English portion a little bit about my uncle. I talk about my family. I lost an uncle during the war, 2 uncles, but there's one that I was a little bit more involved in trying to find his grave and trying to get some justice. And it's something that my mother also wanted to do because she lost her brother. She wants to do everything she can. And now that she's a U.S. citizen and has a little bit of protection from the Salvadoran state. She feels like, let me go to El Salvador and at least find some facts. We got to put a little bit of that into the podcast. And that's the thing. We've all lost someone, whether we lost someone to gang violence, whether we lost someone during the war. Even if we didn't lose one directly, like our elders have a story of losing someone. So it was great that they let me add that. They let me come into their story and just contour it a little bit to the Salvadoran American experience.
What was the most shocking revelation you explored on the podcast?
I think for me was hearing the voices of parents and loved ones who were affected by disappearances in El Salvador. Mm. They never really get the spotlight, partially because a lot of them are scared to speak. Another reason is that Salvadoran society and the government-controlled media are never going to air them out. You're going to spend more time discrediting them. And so we're going to hear wild stories about these people. We never hear about their pain. But also, to me, that's what really humanized it. Like, I'm hearing these voices, and this sounds like it could be my uncle. This sounds like it could be my aunt. And that was really hard to listen to because I'm so used to reading the reports, reading the summaries. So not only was that shocking, but it was also shocking the way they describe being treated by the government, because here we're told that the Nayib Bukele government is for the people. He's lifting up El Salvador. Then why is he discrediting a mother of a disappeared child? Why is he doing these things? The podcast is a really good example of how the government in El Salvador basically plays with the emotions of the loved ones of disappeared people. And I think to me, that's like the most Salvadoran experience sometimes, because so much of our experience is like shaped by colonialism. And, you know, we've all been met with these institutional barriers, whether we know or not.
Mm.
That sort of helplessness that some of the people who've had recently disappeared family members in the podcast, that just echoed the experience of like my mother. My mother's like, I remember feeling like that in 1980 and thinking like, you know, what can I do, and feeling helpless. And so in some ways, I want people to just in my community to just see each other's pain and that humanity and think about ways in which we can stop some of this as a community. That's my goal of the podcast at the end of the day, is to start a conversation about what's happening with El Salvador under the current government. Because like I said, too many people are like, oh, he's a cool president. He is bringing Bitcoin, the same things.
Daniel, outside your own community, what do you hope audiences get out of it?
I just hope that people can learn to discern and question power, whatever that power looks like. And I don't mean it to be just, you got to be contrarian. I just mean, let's think critically about these things. Who could be benefiting from a nefarious activity? You know, if a story's been buried, what more could they be hiding? I want people to not just believe the official narratives that a government gives them, to just question everything. And sometimes, you know, follow your own gut with some of these things. We need to question institutions, and we need to think harder about the implication of all our actions, really.
Absolutely. And we need to think critically when it comes to established narratives, when it comes to institutions that are held sacrosanct. It is very difficult for people to challenge and question that in the US versus in a place like Pakistan. And that could be because people are inherently skeptical of institutions and of governments, how different institutions operate and how they benefit at the expense of general population.
Yes, I think a lot of people don't realize how much propaganda they're actually ingesting.
Yes.
Like, one thing I like to tell people is like, you know, Marvel movies, epic, epic visuals. And this is not a conspiracy theory. You can look it up. Like, you know, a lot of these Marvel movies need sign off from the Pentagon to use that military equipment.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So it's just like, you know, like, enjoy your movie, but think about the implications. Think about the messages that are being kind of put in there. You know, I have to say this because, so one of my favorite pieces that I've ever made was a story for Al Jazeera called Why Are There So Many Palestinians in El Salvador?
And many Palestinian Salvadorans come from just one part of Palestine.
La mayor parte de la migración palestina a El Salvador fueron gente de la ciudad de Belén.
Bethlehem is home to around 29,000 inhabitants. Though exact numbers are unknown, there are claims that almost 100,000 people of Palestinian descent live in El Salvador. There are more Palestinians in El Salvador than Bethlehem now. But how did they all get there?
So we have a Palestinian president. The current president is Palestinian, Nayib Bukele. He's our second president of Palestinian descent. Salvadorans have had Palestinians since the Ottoman Empire. A lot of people fled the Ottoman Empire. So to say that, I wanted to acknowledge that and acknowledge this sort of the current moment we're living in. You're seeing Gen Z really wake up to the propaganda.
Yeah.
And challenge people on human rights and challenge people to be in solidarity with Palestinians. And as someone who comes from war, the generation before me, I feel this as well. And the fact that El Salvador has a strong connection with Palestinians, to me, I'm seeing these protests every day. And it's hard not to think about the fact that people are waking up, people are thinking up critically, and they're waking up and thinking critically in ways that I thought that Americans might never come to.
You're absolutely right, but I hope it sustains.
Yes.
My worry is, what if Gen Z becomes jaded eventually and it doesn't sustain?
Yes, because we've seen that over and over.
Over and over again. Yes. Thank you for saying that, Dania. Thank you for saying it on our platform. In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I'm going to say smoke. Because it's like, UMO is the name of the podcast with smoke. I feel like there's a smoke screen in the United States. It's just like, everything looks hazy. But then, you know, when the smoke clears, you see the reality and you're like, oh my God.
That's so true. But you know what makes me happy, what makes me hopeful, is that there are people out there like you who are speaking truth to power, who are unafraid to challenge narratives, who are able to put themselves in difficult situations to show people what true representation, true advocacy is. If a few people really commit to doing that, then we can really realize the experiment that is the United States of America.
I agree. I think if we want to see this more perfect union, if we want to see this idealized version of the United States that we've been fed, we need to create it. We need to change things. And I try to be hopeful as well, because it's so easy to despair. But, you know, I wouldn't be doing the work I do if I wasn't a little bit hopeful that it could move the needle. And I also feel that I'm also doing this for a lot of people who can't be here today and do it, and keeping their memory alive. And so, yeah, I just hope that this momentum we're in right now doesn't lose some steam. And I hope people also can, you know, reflect on their own community and where they come from to sort of keep them in the fight.
And keep building coalitions.
Yes.
It may not impact you today, but it will eventually impact you. Daniel, where can people find UMO?
So UMO, Murder in Silence in El Salvador, you can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Music. Those are the main three. You can also go to Sonoro Media and search UMO and see if there are any other local platforms to you, but they're on the big platforms for podcasts.
Absolutely. I am listening to it on Apple Podcasts. I am listening to the English version, but as Danielle said, there's a Spanish version if you want to listen to that. And where can people find your work outside UMO?
You can find me on Twitter at Puchicadani. That's P-U-C-H-I-C-A. D-A-N-N-Y, Puchicadani. Puchica just means, oh my God, in Salvadoran vernacular. The same on Instagram is the same name. My bio has my link to my portfolio, so folks can find and contact me there.
Thank you so much, Daniel. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I learned a lot about the history of El Salvador. I will most likely pick up a book and read more and do research and educate myself, because a lot of times we don't. We think we know everything, but we don't. Or we think we don't need to know what's happening around the world, but we really do, because we are all interconnected. I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation. If you did, please share it with a friend. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or go to our website and check out not just Immigrantly, but our other podcasts. Our website is www.immigrantlypod.com. This episode was produced by me, written by Bobak Afshari and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor for this particular podcast episode is Paroma Chakravarti. Theme music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Come back next week when I have another important conversation for all of you.